This is Ecotopia on FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And tonight we're looking, albeit briefly, at connections between science and morality and evolution. Our guest on the phone now is writer, editor, skeptic, and scholar Michael Shermer. He wrote a book called The Science of Good and Evil, which has powerfully influenced my own thought. Michael has also written a number of books and articles about how morals, ethics, and choices emerge from human consciousness. He's a monthly columnist for Atlantic and founder and editor of Skeptic magazine. Welcome, Michael Shermer.
Good evening.
In The Science of Good and Evil, you argue basically that morals and ethics are neither God-given nor formed in a moral vacuum, but you said there are some genetic characteristics or traits that help to determine values. Let's begin by talking about what those characteristics are. Is it in our nature to be moral or immoral or amoral?
All of the above. Yeah, we're a social primate species, and by the logic of natural selection and evolution, in order to in order for a group to survive as a social group, there has to be some means of dealing with conflict between individuals. So there's a tension in our motivations and behaviors to want to be selfish and greedy and get as much as we can for our immediate ourselves and our immediate kin and kind. But then if everybody did that, then the social system would break down. There'd just be too much cheating and lying and stealing and so on. And so we evolved mechanisms to deal with what's generally called free riding. It's called the free rider problem. That is, as soon as you have people starting to be nice and altruistic and friendly, then you're going to get people trying to pinch the system a little bit, cheat a tiny bit. And so we've evolved these moral emotions that, on the one hand, we do like to be cooperative and pro-social and altruistic and nice and to our fellow group members, but on the other hand, we often feel selfish and so on. So we have emotions like guilt, and guilt is an emotion that motivates you to pay close attention to what other people think about you, and if they look at you disapprovingly, it feels bad, and so that's a good emotion to have to keep you in line so that you don't want to continue to cheat the system. And so we shun people that are free riders that you know, try to get something for nothing or are not pulling their weight and that sort of thing. You can see this in hunter-gatherer groups. They have elaborate rituals. They don't need written rules because there's not that many people in these groups, maybe a couple dozen to a couple hundred. Everybody knows one another or related to one another. So they resolve conflicts by everybody sits down in the quad and the big man tells everybody to shut up, and now you have your say, and then he has his say, and then we talk it out and then decide what to do, and you have to go along with it, and if you don't, then you know we're going to throw you off, throw you out. So that's how that's resolved. What happened about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago is as these small bands and tribes began to coalesce into chiefdoms and states, population numbers grew from a couple hundred to a couple thousand to ten thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions. There was too much opportunity for free riding to take place. In a big anonymous society, people can get away with stuff. So that's when government and religion evolved as really just as means of rule enforcement and behavior control and conflict resolution. And so that's the start of modern society. It really all comes down to morality and just making sure that everybody gets a copy of the rules, and here's the penalties if you violate the rules. And by the way, if you think you got away with it, you didn't, because there's an invisible eye in the sky that keeps track of everything. Mm-hmm. And in the next life, you're going to get it. So that's government and religion.
Can you explain, I'm working on this connection between genetics and cultural evolution. Do you see genetics as evolving, changing as these habits are developed, or do we have kind of a parallel or co-evolutionary development?
Well, certainly both. It's all interactive between genes and, yes, and culture. So in essence, just think of the immoral emotions like any other emotions, like hunger. So we've evolved certain emotions regarding food. We like sweet and fatty foods because in an ancestral environment, the kinds of foods that taste sweet and are rich in fat are at once both rare and nutritious. And so the more of it you can get, the better, because you know, you never know when you're going to get to eat again. So we have no satiation mechanism. There's just no shut-off. There's no topping it off. It's like the more the better. if a piece of chocolate cake is good, two is even better, and three is best still, right? And so we feel that way about those. And now nobody's calculating calories or anything like that. You just feel hungry. And like with sexual reproduction, we find ourselves attracted to certain people, and there's a lot of studies that show, for example, men are attracted to women with symmetrical faces and clear complexion and 0.67 waist-to-hip ratio. Now, nobody walks into a dance club or nightclub with calipers measuring waist-to-hip ratios, and, you know, oh, 0.67, perfect! How would you like to come home with me? No, nobody does that. They just look around, and they feel attracted. And so the feeling, the emotions are proxies for the calculations done by natural selection. And so the same is true with other emotions, including the moral emotions. You feel guilt and shame at having cheated somebody or violated a social norm, and it feels bad when people talk about you in a negative way. So gossip, for example, a lot of research on gossip shows that it's mostly about what other people think of other people and what they're doing, you know, regarding morals, you know, who's sleeping with who and who has power and who's cheating and lying and who's a really nice guy and who's generous and, you know, those sorts of things. And so all that's an evolved, so it's genetic in a sense that we come equipped with a moral toolkit that then gets tweaked by culture, much like language. Everybody on Earth speaks language, but which one you speak, it depends on which where you happen to have been born. And so it's like that with morality. So what the evolutionary psychologist wants to know is why you feel guilty about doing this or doing that, but why you feel guilty about anything. What's the purpose of guilt? And for that, we need an ultimate, deeper explanation that comes from evolution.
I have a question about religion and government, especially religion. What happens with the breakdown of religion in a large culture that then is not overseeing everything that you do, and you don't feel attached to it, and that's not a means by which you're governed?
Right. Well, this is this was discussed by the founders of the United States, when they were basically arguing, we're going to be a self-governing nation rather than having a king, and we're going to break up the power structure so that nobody has too much power, and therefore self-governance. Well, self-governance requires an internal moral compass, and at the time, it was really religion was the only game in town,
right.
And the Enlightenment was kind of just getting going. So people like Jefferson and Franklin and Paine and so on were, you know, toying with ideas of, you know, how can we ground this in natural law? So they, you know, they hardly used the language of religion in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and so on. And well, they don't at all in the Constitution, a little bit in the Declaration of Independence, but the idea was is that, you know, these things come from within, and where do we get that? Well, the knee-jerk response everybody gives, well, religion. But if you take the bigger look, the bigger picture, well, there was no religion prior to civilization. There was just, you know, these little animistic beliefs that hunter-gatherers had that would be unrecognizable to modern religious believers. So so the moral sentiments come first, religions come later, grafted onto that. And, you know, sometimes they got it right and sometimes they didn't. The basic stuff that's in some of the Ten Commandments, like not cheating and lying and stealing and murdering, those sorts of things. It's not like we needed the people that authored those to tell us that. I mean, like, we wouldn't have figured that out on our own. You just, you know, ask your spouse, is it okay if I sleep around? They'll let you know. You don't have to read it in the Bible. They'll tell you right away, no, it's not okay. So, you know, that's inborn. That's deeply ingrained.
Could we talk a little more about the sense of community in The Science of Good and Evil? You point out, and you said earlier in the program, that communities continually get larger. And, of course, we've got 7 billion people on planet Earth with a potential of 9.2 if nothing happens. Are there optimal sizes to communities? I think you said in the book, each time communities get larger, certain problems emerge and certain effectiveness of the community diminishes. I guess where I'm going is, will we ever have a global community that works? Hi, are you still there?
Let's take a short break and let's try calling back.
We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
Too much technology. We're back with Michael Shermer, editor and founder of The Skeptic magazine, author of a number of books. His newest book is The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. We're asking a little bit about the optimal size of community, but we'd also be equally interested in your assertion that beliefs come first and explanations for beliefs follow.
Yeah, so on the size of community, we know from research that about the magic number 150 seems to fit a lot of different conditions. So that's enough people that you have some power, you can do something as a social group, and not so many that you feel anonymous. Mm-hmm. So like the ideal number for an army company is, you know, about 130, 140, 150. Hunter-gatherer groups tend to hover around that number of 150. When corporations get larger, they tend to break up into smaller departments of, you know, a couple dozen to a couple hundred. So it's the idea that who we know and feel that we really care about is what binds a community together. And so fundraisers know this. For example, you can show ads or commercials of, you know, 10,000 starving people in Africa, and you will raise X number of dollars. But if you show one little child with a name and a face and and his hobbies and where he lives, you're going to raise, you know, 10x dollars. And so because it sort of tricks the brain. That little, you know, I call it the Ndugu effect after the Jack Nicholson film about Schmidt, where he adopts that little child named Ndugu. And Ndugu becomes an honorary family member and friend. Whereas 10,000 people, I just can't relate. I just don't care. I can't care. It's not possible. And so in a big society, that's why, you know, we have states and then we have cities and counties and towns and communities and bowling leagues and churches and, you know, YMCAs and gyms and, you know, you name it, we belong to all sorts of groups, including skeptics groups, atheist groups. You know, there's actually a richly growing, rapidly developing group of secularists, skeptics, atheists, agnostics, free thinkers, and humanists and so on that meet periodically every week. They go, you know, they meet at the pub, you know, atheists at the pub, or they meet at restaurants and they have dinner together. They go, you know, we do it here at Caltech. We have lectures and we all go out to dinner afterwards. Everybody's invited. It's a big fun thing. And, you know, everybody likes to be part of a community. That's what makes us human, really. So I think one of the things that bothers atheists is that religious people act like they have a monopoly on that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And that's no good. You know, we want in on that action. So we develop our own groups.
And to Steve's point, beliefs come first, explanations for beliefs follow. Do beliefs develop from the ground up? They're passed on, they're adapted, and then we say, here's why we believe that? How does that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so our brains are very modular. They evolve to solve certain problems in our ancestral environment. And so as a rapid cognition, no time to really think all this through, you just have to make snap decisions about things. You just, the moment you understand something, the tendency is to just believe it. You know, I saw it, I believed it. I read it, I believed it. Somebody told me, I believed it. That's sort of a survival strategy, because oftentimes those sources are right. Authorities, it's okay to obey authorities, you know, not, it's, we don't want to be blind about it, but, you know, usually authorities tend to give us good advice. And so when social psychologists trick subjects into doing stupid things because an authority told them,
right,
you know, it's, that's a little bit of a cheat, because really most of the advice our parents give us, for example, is good advice. And so our brains are evolved to pay attention to authorities and things like that. So the problem with science is that it's so new, and the whole system of, like, running an experiment and testing and corroboration and so on, and evidence evaluation, that's that doesn't come natural. That requires effort and training. And, you know, my instincts are, boy, what I feel is right, just got to be right. I'm going to collect all the evidence I can to fit it. And my brain is like a lawyer. You know, it's like I'm just going to marshal the facts to fit my client, in this case, my beliefs. So to think like a scientist is not natural. To think like a lawyer is natural. So we just look for evidence that fits us and our beliefs.
And so really, that's then how you can account for example, for racist groups who are able to justify hating another whole group of people on the basis of, or Nazi Germany. I was a brief time a curator for a traveling exhibit for Anne Frank that talked on Anne Frank exhibit that talked about how over the 20s and 30s, people in Germany were told stories about what was right, and they believed those stories, and that's how things got out of hand.
Yes, exactly. So we're tribal. I mentioned the fact that we're, you know, in a social primate species. So within our groups, we're pretty moral and pro-social and cooperative. Between groups, we tend to be less cooperative. We tend to, you know, trust with verification. That's what, like the potlatch, where two, you know, mm-hmm. adjacent groups, hunter-gatherers, throw a big feast for each other. Well, that has nothing to do with food sharing because of lack of calories. That has to do with social bonding and developing trust, because otherwise I'm going to not trust you at all, because other groups can be dangerous. And so we have this propensity to tribalize other groups and make them into the enemy.
Right.
And so if you're, of course, it depends where you happen to be born, but if you're primed
right.
for that, then the government-controlled media can just feed that.
Right.
And that's why the enemies are always animal-like. They're not really human. They're cockroaches, or they're vermin, or they're rats, or they're lice, you know, that sort of thing.
At the same time, you've also written a good deal recently about free will, whether we have it or not. And I want to quote a story you wrote recently where you said in a restaurant you were tempted to order a heavy stout beer, a buttery escargot appetizer, a marbled steak, cheesecake, and instead, you chose a light beer, salmon, and a salad with vinaigrette dressing, and you split a chocolate cake dessert with your companion. You then implied that you had no choice in the matter.
Right.
What's up with that?
I believe in free will. I do. I don't have any choice about that. so now you're quoting my Scientific American article there on
yes.
We won't. I do think that, of course, we live in a determined universe, but I think the choices we make within our own brain, there still are choices. The choices are within the causal net of a determined universe. So I'm not negating determinism,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not invoking anything supernatural or paranormal or extra, you know, outside the universe or anything like that. It's just that we are bombarded both externally and internally with all kinds of temptations and ideas and thoughts and so on that we have to pick and choose from, because you can't do everything. So.
Right.
In the process of making those choices, you can even be cognizant of the conditions that are more likely to lead you to make a certain choice. So that's why it's good to go food shopping, on a full stomach rather than an empty
mm-hmm.
stomach.
Right.
And because then you're more likely to not buy the foods that your future self are going to want, because right now you're starving and that tempts your future self to want the Haagen-Dazs ice cream or the Ben & Jerry's ice cream or whatever. Basically, there's multiple yous. There's not one you. There's
right.
the you now. There's the future you.
Sure.
You know, there's even web pages that you can pay a money And then if you violate it, you lose your money for the betting on your future self, and then you know you have that hanging over you as a condition.
Wow. So are we getting any better? I mean, we constantly see, choices of war over peace, hierarchy over equality, consumption over sustainability. We interview a lot of people on this show who talk about how deeply troubled the world is. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about our abilities to make choices that are what? More humane, more kinder, gentler. Are we making good choices? Or
we are.
Can
yes.
we?
My next book is called The Moral Arc, and it's inspired by Martin Luther King's from his How Long, Not Long speech, in which he says the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Things are much better, way better. The most conservative person, the most conservative of the general conservatives in America today are way more liberal than liberals were half a century ago.
Really?
They've been swept along by the liberal revolution in democracies, for example. In 1900, there were zero liberal democracies in the world, not one. Women couldn't vote anywhere. Hmm. Now there's something on the order of, I think, 87 liberal democracies and climbing. I mean, this is all good news, and I would recommend your listeners read Steve Pinker's new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature.
You're the second person who's told me that we need to read that.
You got
to
get it.
Yeah, no, so the guests you have on your show that are pessimistic, they are short-term thinkers. They are subject to the same cognitive bias we all are, which is we only notice the immediate tragic and negative events. Our brains are geared to do that, so that's why you need science. That's why you need graphs and charts to go, wait a minute, wait, look, there's far fewer wars than there used to be. You know, in the last 500 years, Germany, France, and Great Britain, and so on, have been at war with each other every year for 500 years, and then it all stopped in 1945. Done. Can you imagine, for example, the French invading the English now, through the Trump?
Right. Uh-huh.
No, not going to happen. It will not happen, especially if they have a common currency. So, economic voting, economic blocks in which countries are allowed to trade with one another is a great way to attenuate war and conflict between them, because if nothing else, the Chinese make my computers and my iPhone. I don't want to go to war with the Chinese. I need them. In any case, what's wrong with Chinese? There's nothing wrong with them. So, the whole process of the spread of liberal democracy and open economic borders for trade has made the world a more moral place. That is, more people are considered part of the tribe, honorary members of the human race that we do not need to kill. And I think that's good news.
Good news, in fact. We've been talking with Michael Shermer. He's the founder of the Skeptic Society, editor-in-chief of its magazine. He's a skeptic and an optimist, obviously. We would invite listeners to check out his work at www.michaelshermer.com and www.skeptic.com. You can also check out his new book, The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies. Michael, thank you very much for being with us tonight, and especially for dealing with complex issues in a short period of time.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was a great discussion. Thank you.
You're welcome.